I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Lizzie O'Leary's on vacation. She'll be back next week. Usually on this show, we talk about big economic issues and how they affect you in a big way. This week, we're getting small. Rather, we're talking about minimums, the minimum wage, the minimum you need to do to get your financial house in order, the minimum amount of fossil fuel that's needed to keep the lights on. So do you have something small or big to tell us? You can visit us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, check out Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Let's get things rolling with this week's GOP debate. One of the things that was striking, though perhaps not surprising, was the way the candidates responded with a minimum amount of details and specifics anytime they were asked about the economy. For example,
you get in and you change every aspect of regulations that are job killers. You get rid of Obamacare and replace it with something that doesn't suppress wages and kill jobs.
And
I think most of us in America understand that people, not the government, creates jobs. And one of the best things we can do is get the government out of the way, repeal Obamacare.
And
we had great economic growth, we cut taxes, and we had a big surplus. Economic growth is the key. Economic growth is the key to everything.
To talk about this trend of minimizing the big issues, I'm joined by Lisa Desjardins. She's political director of PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back.
Hi, great to be back.
So this doesn't seem like a new thing, but this week's debate sort of highlighted the fact that if you're running to be the most powerful man or woman in the world, it doesn't seem like you need to offer a lot of specifics when it comes to how you're going to address economic issues.
That's right. I think when you look at the minimum that a politician has to say in answer to a serious question, especially about the economy, which is complex, the minimum, sad to say, is nothing. They can spend a lot of time and use a lot of words saying pretty much nothing. And I think we hear that even from some candidates who are giving specifics. And that's where it gets tricky. You can kind of know when someone's, you know, not saying much, being vague. But take, for example, I've been watching Jeb Bush, former Florida governor, and he's made one very specific proposal. He says he is going to boost the economy 4% GDP every year he is president. That's really specific. But okay, how do you do that?
Well, how indeed. In fact, I've got the clip here from a voters forum from earlier in the week. Let's give a listen.
I think we can grow our economy at 4% instead of this anemic 2%.
You think we can get
the 4% absolutely. GDP? Yeah, and the fact that Paul Krugman disagrees with me warms my heart. The fact is we can grow at that rate. It will require fixing a few really big complex things.
Okay, wait, let's go to the videotape on that. It will require fixing a few big complex things. Is that all?
Right, just the economy. It will require fixing the economy. Yes, exactly. And I think another one that is a huge issue this week and for the rest of the Republican contest is immigration. I think pretty much every listener knows what I'm going to say next. A lot of these Republicans will say, we have to secure the border. That's the first thing they'll say. And, you know, if you really look at the immigration issue, which is a massive economic issue in this country, no matter what you think about it, the truth is that most of the Republican candidates, you might be surprised, are in the middle and haven't really said if they think illegal immigrants, those in the country illegally now, should be able to stay or not. Most of them, including Donald Trump, are kind of open to the idea of some status, but they're not going to say that. They're only going to say border security.
Well, and I think there's a reason for that, because while rank-and-file voters might feel very emotional about undocumented workers, the business world has been pushing back a little bit and saying, you know what, we're talking about 13 million, 14 million people. You pull them out of the equation, who's going to do that work?
Right, that's right. And I think it's interesting. I actually had a conversation with Ben Carson this week, one-on-one, before the debate, and his position previously had been that undocumented workers should be allowed to stay, but they have to go back to their home country first and apply as guest workers. I asked him about that. You know, we're just sitting in a kind of waiting room together, basically. And he said, no, actually, I've been speaking to farmers, and now I believe that those undocumented workers should stay in the country and apply from here. That's a pretty big shift, but you don't hear him talking about that too much on the ground. And the reason is because he's hearing from businesses that's something that they want. But this gets to this idea of the minimum. You know, he could definitely say more. Maybe he will say more in the future, but he is listening, but we're not hearing necessarily all of that in all of the speeches.
What's very striking here is that I'm always advising consumers to make informed decisions about the things they're going to buy. Yet when it comes to making informed political decisions, we're given as little information as possible. Take, for example, Social Security or Medicare, for that matter. Everybody agrees these are problems that need to be addressed. Everybody agrees that there are only a handful of solutions that are on the table. Yet you ask the candidates, either Republican or Democrat, what specifically are you going to do? And they'll dodge it. They'll say, well, that's something that we'll talk about later on.
That's right. And I think what we have in this Republican field and pretty much among politicians in general is each candidate might have one thing where they're sort of sticking their neck out. Not all of them do. But Chris Christie is an example here where he has gone beyond the minimum. He is saying that he would make cuts to future entitlements to and he would also raise how much the wealthy would be paying into and getting and lower how much they would get out of Social Security and Medicare. So he's gone farther than some others. Also, Lindsey Graham is in that category as well. But, you know, that is one of our largest problems in this country. We need leaders who can tell us what they would do about it. And we're not. We're getting the minimum, which is really, like I said, nothing. They can get away with just saying not much.
Lisa Desjardins is political director of PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
One place where you'll find some minimums, at least if you look carefully, is the supermarket. Look at the shelves. Look at the products you like. Are they getting smaller? Well, that's not your fading eyesight. That's, in fact, the real deal. In many cases, you're paying the same or more for less. And that seems to be a growing trend. To talk about that, I'm joined by Edgar Dworsky. He's founder of ConsumerWorld.org. Hiya, Edgar.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And, you know, this is something that just drives me nuts. The idea that you're going to go buy a favorite product, whether it's cookies or spices or whatever, and the package looks basically the same. It's just a little smaller. You can't quite tell, but it's a little smaller. What's going on?
Well, this is a very sneaky practice of product manufacturers. When they're faced with a price increase, they know consumers are very price conscious, and they'll know if you raise the price of the orange juice from $2.99 to $3.29. But if they can take out a few ounces from the container in an inconspicuous way, typically leaving the packaging almost the same, they've kind of put one over on the consumers. The consumer is paying the same price, so they don't notice they're getting less, which is a backdoor price increase.
And why is it that we don't notice? Are we that unobservant? Is it because we don't read how many fluid ounces are in there? Why is it that we're so easily duped by this?
We're not net weight conscious. We certainly are conscious about the size of products. So you know if you're buying mayonnaise, you know, do you buy the little jar, the medium size kind of quart size one, or the jumbo one? But we don't tend to look every time we buy the item at the net weight and memorize it. And then come back the next time and see, oh, it changed a little bit. We tend to be price conscious, not net weight conscious.
Therefore, if the price is unchanged and the package is not noticeably different, chances are it'll slip right past us.
Exactly right.
Oh, my goodness. And what about the savings for the manufacturer? If they take out an ounce here or a little bit there, does it make a big difference?
Well, think about it. Tuna fish is one of the classic items that's been downsized. Tuna fish started about 7 ounces, then it went to 6.5, and then 6.25, and 6.125, and 6 ounces, and 5 ounces. Take out an ounce of tuna from a can. You may not miss it that much in your sandwich, but think about the manufacturer. How many millions or billions of cans did that manufacturer save an ounce from? And that adds up to an awful lot of pounds and tons of tuna and big money for the manufacturer.
Another prominent one, and this one's fairly recent, is toilet paper, where you're either getting a thicker roll in the middle or fewer sheets surrounding it.
You know, the original Charmin had 600 or 650 sheets on a roll. Today's double rolls of Charmin are about 164 sheets. So it's not your imagination. Gee, didn't I just put that toilet paper in the holder a couple of days ago? And it's gone.
I believe when Charmin got busted on this, and they never, of course, announced that they were offering less, but their answer was, oh, well, don't worry, because we're using a higher quality paper, therefore you need fewer sheets, to which I say, don't you tell me how many sheets I need.
Manufacturers come up with all kinds of excuses why they do it. They will say one of the classic ones when Folgers coffee, remember the old 16-ounce cans of coffee, has gone down to 13, in some cases, 11. They said, well, we fluffed up the beans to expose more surfaces of the beans, and we just couldn't get that full pound in the pound can anymore. So we're giving the consumer less.
I'm sorry, did you say we fluffed up the beans?
That's right. There's actually a fluffer for beans.
I want that on a t-shirt. My beans are fluffed. So we know why businesses are doing this. We know that we as consumers are falling prey to this. Is there anything to do, or is this just the way things are?
Well, it's been this way for decades and decades. I don't see it stopping. When we have a run of higher raw material prices, that's one of the reasons manufacturers are faced, with a quandary. Do I raise the price of the item or do I take some of it out of the package? We have to be vigilant. You have to not only remember the price you paid last time, remember what the net weight or net count was on the package. That way, you'll at least know if you're getting less for your money.
Actually, when I lived in Japan once, they shrank one of the products and they advertised it as more convenient. I'm thinking, more convenient is less.
Well, I will tell you, I was at a store once and it was a grand opening and I was in the cookie aisle. And there happened to be a representative from Nabisco there, and Oreos had just downsized. It went from 16 ounces to 15 point, whatever it was. And I commented about the downsizing. And, the spin master that this person was, he said, well, think about it. Fewer calories.
Oh, that's smart. That's very impressive. Edgar Dworsky is founder of ConsumerWorld.org. Edgar, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, David.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, in for the vacationing Lizzie O'Leary. It's a small world, after all, as we look at minimums in our economy. However, let's take a short break from that and look at the big picture, some of the numbers in the news this week, which you can find at Marketplace's Buy the Numbers blog. That's at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony?
Thanks, David. Our first number is
100%.
That's a share of profits that'll be donated from sales of the Cecil the Lion Beanie Baby.
The Wildlife Conservation Research Unit of the University of Oxford will get the money. They had been studying Cecil before he was hunted by Walter Palmer, a dentist from Minnesota.
The Beanie Baby version of Cecil will be available to buy in September.
2.
That's how many ads were purchased by Arby's during Jon Stewart's second-to-last episode of The Daily Show.
It's a tongue-in-cheek move by the fast food chain. Jon Stewart's been pretty relentless about teasing them over the years.
Isn't there anywhere else we can eat? Technically, it's food. Why not challenge your stomach to a fight?
3-2.
That's how the vote split in an SEC ruling that makes companies disclose the pay gap between CEOs and their employees.
Leaving some employees exclaiming, CEO, oh my God, that's how much you make?
Ugh.
Solid,
Tobin.
Super solid.
The other day, the Obama administration said it wants to see 28% of the nation's energy coming from renewable sources by the year 2030. In other words, 72% will still be from fossil fuels. Well, that got us thinking, what's the minimum that's actually doable when it comes to oil, coal, natural gas? How little could we actually get away with? To try and answer that question, we're joined by Scott Tong. He's Marketplace's sustainability correspondent. Hello, Scott.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good. And I know it's kind of a loaded question because we're obviously putting on our little thinking caps and speculating here, but it's kind of an interesting thought experiment that if we're setting this target of 28% renewables, and if thus we're looking at 3/4 of fossil fuels, well, why these numbers? I mean, I'm guessing there's some politics involved, but if we could actually go all in with renewables, mm-hmm. I don't know if we'd get all the way there, but is there an actual minimum that we would need when it comes to coal and oil and natural gas?
Well, so you've come upon a part of the world that most of us, including me, don't know about, and that is the people who run the power grid. These are the people who are not just doing these thought experiments, but running these numbers and scenarios and seeing if we could actually get there. So the people who run the grid, I visited one of the offices in the New England area, and I talked to these people. They don't talk about good and bad energy. They all talk about trade-offs in the energy space. So oil. Right? You get a lot of energy packed into a little tiny space, but the trade-off, of course, is it pollutes. Renewable energy, especially solar and wind, they're clean, but they have a big trade-off. And the big trade-off there is they're not always on, right? Sometimes a cloud comes, sometimes it's night, sometimes the wind doesn't blow. And that presents a real problem with these renewable sources. So when you don't have that source, you need to get it really quickly from somewhere else to keep the power grid going, to keep it in balance. And that's where you still need natural gas and other fossil fuels to kind of tap into that in a hurry. And so that's the big balance these grid operators have.
Do people still talk about bridge technologies? For example, if we're going to make a big push on renewables, but we acknowledge that we still have to have some dependence on fossil fuels, is there some talk about, well, maybe we can rely more on nuclear, for example, or hydrogen or something along those lines as an in-between until we go out and find dilithium crystals and everything's, you know, Star Trek?
The center of the bridge conversation is natural gas. And the way people think about it is, okay, natural gas compared to coal emits about half of the carbon dioxide. So for planetary reasons, can natural gas be a bridge to a future of renewables? And so natural gas can substitute for coal in a lot of places. We're seeing that already in a lot of the country. And then with renewables, you could have a grid that has, you know, increasingly more renewables and less natural gas over time. So how much? Well, what's really interesting is right now, there are a lot of studies that say you can go 30% renewables and 70% something else, you know, mostly fossil fuels. But they're doing some studies now where they're pretty confident that they can get to 80% renewables. They have the technology there to do it, in which case, you know, we're almost across the bridge. There's not so much of this always electricity from natural gas or another fossil fuel or nuclear to kind of fill in that gap. The big question is, how much does it cost? That's the technology's there. The question is, where's the money come from?
So is that the only thing? If we wanted to get to 80% renewables, it's only a question of finance?
Well, the engineering people say we can do it. The people in Germany, which is already at 29% renewables, they say we can get there. So before, you know, interestingly, 20 years ago, you know, people in the power sector said, okay, you know, maybe we can get to 3% renewables, but then the grid might fall over then. Or maybe 5%, but then you're really pushing it. And then a decade ago, they were worried about 10%. Now we're at 30. So it's really moving fast. And the engineering people say, we can get there. 80% neighborhood, maybe even 100%. You know, they're doing that modeling and they say, technology-wise, we can get there.
What can each of us do to do our share? Should we all go solar on our roofs right away?
If you go solar on your roof, right, you're pulling less energy from the power grid. So that makes life easier for the power grid. So that's one thing you can do. Of course, one energy economist said, you know, individuals, you know, what you can do as an individual person is part of the noise because the scale of this thing is so big. And what this energy economist said is what you can really do is put your mind to policy. That is, if you care about it, you can support policies. You know, you may be a fan of this EPA clean power rule. That's just one example. You can support those. And that's how you get the scale to get us from here to there.
Scott Tong is Marketplace's sustainability correspondent. Scott, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Well, let's wipe the oil from our hands and pick up our smartphones as you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hiya, Ben.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. And, you know, I'm as much of an e-waster as the next guy, I suppose. I'd like to think that I recycle. I'd like to think that I love the planet. But I know full well that every broken down old printer or defunct old PC that I put back into the food chain is just complicating things. When we talk about e-waste, how big a problem is it?
Well, you're totally right. It is actually a pretty big problem, and it's growing. The United Nations estimates that we threw out 41 million metric tons of e-waste in 2014, and that by 2018, we will be throwing out 50 million. So, you know, when you think of a metric ton, it's, you know, maybe about the size and weight of an elephant. And now if you can think of 50 million elephants in one place, you've got a sense, right? Now, on a global scale, that may not seem like too much trash, but the issue is growing. It's increasing a lot. We're throwing away more electronics than we ever have. Right now, most e-waste comes from kitchen equipment, washers, dryers, but printers, phones, tablets, and computers are quickly becoming a big part of the issue here.
Yeah, in other words, every time the word upgrade comes around, we all get excited. But the reality is something is going to leave and it's going to have to park somewhere. So
yes.
How do I be a responsible e-waster?
Okay, so the first thing you want to do when you get your new iPhone 6S, right, before you minimize the environmental impact of your old gadget, is you want to minimize the potential impact of getting your data pulled from that device by someone you don't want pulling your data. So if you're working with a phone or a tablet, you could start by backing up your information or transferring it to your new device. And then it's good to do what's called a factory reset or a hard reset on the device. You can usually find that option in your settings. And after you do that, go back to your contacts or your inbox or recent calls or something to check and make sure there's no information there and that you were successful with the reset.
What about the actual gadget? I mean, I'm going to drop that at some point.
Yes, you will. It's by the way, a little bit more complicated for computers. You know, you have to back up to stuff to an external hard drive and things like that and do a system wipe. And once you're ready to actually get rid of the device itself, you can pick from actually a growing list of options of how to get rid of it. Step one, of course, is to not just throw it in the kitchen trash can, which, you know, some of us have been guilty of in the past.
Yeah, wait. Time out. You've actually thrown an old iPhone or something into the kitchen trash?
I'm pretty sure I've thrown out a cell phone. You know, in my early days of cell phone ownership, I just threw one out. But
stop and think about what a 21st century problem that is, that you're actually throwing out a small computer.
Yes.
Amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
It's absolutely
amazing.
Isn't it
amazing? And we do it more and more. And if you don't want to do it that way, you consider a few options here. You could consider donating it or recycling it. To a certain degree, you could also resell it if it has a resale value. So you could go on Amazon or eBay or something like that and actually take a look and see if the device is selling for an amount of cash that would be worth it for you. And then once you wipe the device, potentially, you could put it up online and sell it. If you don't want to sell it, you can maybe sometimes give it back to your wireless carrier, for instance. Sometimes they'll give you a discount or you can trade it in, and then they will refurbish that device for someone else. There are also nonprofit organizations that do this, like Cell Phones for Soldiers, which is pretty much what it sounds like. Large electronic stores like Staples, Best Buy do it for free. And if you, like my dad and I, love a good trip to the dump, you can actually check and see if your local facility does electronics disposal. Maybe pick up some trash to bring back home with you on the way, you know, when you make the trip.
Do I want to ask about how you bond with your father at the dump?
You know, we like looking through, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing to see what other people throw away, right? Electronics or otherwise.
It's true. And you have that Courtship of Eddie's father moment that is just, it's so important. All right. So I'm thinking that I'm a good and environmental consumer. But does it really make that big a difference? I mean, on a global scale?
All right. Let me give you one last set of numbers, David. So this is according to the EPA, which actually has a lot of good information about what to do with your device, as does the FTC, by the way. For every million cell phones recycled, according to the EPA, 35,000 pounds of copper, 772 pounds of silver, and 33 pounds of palladium are recovered. This stuff is harder and harder to pull out of the earth, and where it comes from is sometimes problematic. And as we look to the future, David, well, where we'll potentially be replacing a lot more of our home electronics with smart Wi-Fi connected, you know, refrigerators and washers and on, our e-waste is really only going to go up.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide, as always, to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, David.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app from the iTunes Store or Google Play. We're talking about minimizing things this week, but there's one thing you definitely don't want to minimize, and that's your paycheck. Nevertheless, what you're pulling down, it's not keeping up with inflation. According to the latest numbers from the federal government, wages and salaries rose in the most recent quarter by a record low 0.2%. In economic terms, that's basically bupkis. To talk about that, we're joined by Elise Gould. She's senior economist at the labor-backed Economic Policy Institute. Hi, Elise.
Hi.
So when I look at a number like that, 0.2% growth in wages and salaries, I'm thinking, boy, that and another $1.50 will get you a latte.
Right, right. I think that it's true across the board. People are just hurting. They're not seeing any real increases to their wages, nothing meaningful happening in wages. And we've seen that for about 5 years now.
But what's at the root of that? Because in this time, we've seen the economy recovering, the housing sector recovering, the unemployment rate coming down. In other words, more people getting jobs. All of that should add up, you'd think, to a more vibrant economic situation where we're all pulling down better coin. Doesn't seem to be happening.
That's right. I think the key word is that we're recovering. The economy is slowly moving in the right direction. It seems that slowly is the key word here. We saw even stronger job growth last year than we've seen this year, but it's happening slowly. The unemployment rate has been coming down slowly, but the labor force participation rate has still not recovered. There are still about 3 million missing workers that haven't returned to the economy. Employers know this. Employers know that there are people out there that are willing to take your job, and therefore you don't have the bargaining power to bid up your wages.
Well, and as a result of that, with wages this low, that can potentially have a vicious cycle effect because, let's all remember, consumer spending accounts for about 2/3 of GDP in the United States. Thus, if we're not paying workers a good paycheck, they don't have the money to go out and buy the things that make the jobs.
That's exactly right. There's a demand problem. And if we could put more money in people's paychecks, more money in people's pockets, and they could spend that, there'd be more demand for goods and services. Therefore, employers would have to produce more goods and services, provide more services, produce more goods. And if they to do that, they would have to hire more workers. And that would get us on a much better cycle.
Here's a stat that really opened my eyes the other day, that since 1978, the average pay for working stiffs in this country up by about 11%. But over that same time frame, average pay for CEOs up 1,000%. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, it seems pretty clear that CEOs have a lot more bargaining power in the economy today. So now they're making about 300 times more. Absolutely.
Again, some stats. Apparently, the average CEO of a large company now makes about $16.3 million, whereas the average ordinary worker pulling down about $35,000. That's a big gap.
Yes. It is a big gap. And I think that the productivity of each of those workers has increased over time, right? As low-wage workers have gotten more educated over time, clearly they've become more productive. And yet we don't feel like it's necessary to pay them. It's hard to imagine that those executives, that their productivity warrants those kind of salary increases. Honestly, their compensation packages are settled in boardrooms among their peers. They're not having to bargain for their sort of living wage.
So what will it take to remedy wage stagnation? Does it take a more robust employment market whereby ordinary workers are able to drive a harder bargain? Does it take stronger collective bargaining on the part of organized labor? How on earth do you reverse something like this?
Those both are two very good ways. We actually have at EPI, we have a Raising America's Pay agenda, and those are two top items. Absolutely. If we can tighten the labor market like we did in the late 90s, we lower the unemployment rate, but lower it in a meaningful way so that all workers out there haven't just left the labor force because they see weak job opportunities, but they've come back and they're actively seeking employment and a lot more people are unemployed. When that happens and you don't have those people waiting online for those jobs, then employers will have to offer more to attract and retain the best workers. And then you'll see wages rise.
Is there any possibility that a minimum wage would be indexed to inflation?
Well, that has been proposed to try to raise the minimum wage and then have it rise. And there are some states and localities that are doing that. They have automatic increases in the minimum wage in their area that is targeted every year to rises in inflation. And that can absolutely be implemented.
So at the moment, we're looking at 0.2% growth in wages and salaries, maybe 2% or 3% inflation. Sounds like I'm making less than I was just a few months ago.
Well, in some cases, that's absolutely true. If we look at the last business cycle peak in 2007, the bottom 70% of wage earners actually don't have higher wages today than they did in 2007. And that's that sort of inequality persists, and it's only those at the very top that are actually seeing real gains.
Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Elise, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend, I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Lizzie O'Leary. How much you make has been a hot topic in the news lately. The presidential candidates, they've been talking about a potential minimum wage increase. Cities like Los Angeles and Seattle, they've raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And this week, the Securities and Exchange Commission voted to require greater disclosure by companies on how much the boss makes. Or, to put that another way, how little you probably make in comparison. Drew DeSilver is a senior writer at the Pew Research Center. He's here to explore the issue with us. Hiya, Drew.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about what we've been seeing primarily in the fast food industry, this idea of a $15 hourly federal minimum wage. Is that enough?
I think that depends a lot on where you live. $15 means one thing if you live in Manhattan, New York. It means another thing if you live in Manhattan, Kansas. And the cost of living in this country varies so much from place to place that one of the challenges that policymakers have is coming up with a minimum wage level that applies to equally to everyone or is fair to everyone. And it's very, very hard to do. Economists have been researching the minimum wage and the effects on employment and the economy in general pretty much ever since the very first national minimum wage was established 70-odd years ago. And I think it's fair to say that the conclusion is that no one has any consensus. Some economists find tremendous effects. Some economists find small negative effects. Some find small positive effects. Some find no effects at all. And the research is really, I wouldn't say it's all over the map, but it's pretty close to all over the map.
Well, let's look at that $15 figure, which seems to be the talking point now for a federal minimum wage. Why $15? Why not $12? Why not $20? Why not $50?
It could be anything, I suppose. $15 seems to have emerged as the goal for the labor movement. Senator Sanders, of course, has introduced or is introducing legislation to mandate a $15 an hour minimum wage. That would be over twice what the current federal minimum wage is, which is $7.25 an hour, although 29 states and the District of Columbia have mandated their own higher levels within their own states. And several cities have done the same thing.
I've heard from some people who said, well, if people at the lower end get a 100% raise, why don't I get one too?
Well, you might. One of the effects of the minimum wage tends to be as a floor for other wages. And if employers want to maintain the same wage differentials from between the lowest paid employees and higher paid employees, then if the minimum wage goes up, then other wages presumably would go up too.
And what about people who are exempt from a minimum wage, whether it's at the federal or state level?
What we know about those people is that there are several groups that are exempt from the minimum wage, some disabled workers. There's a training wage for young workers, some high school students. But the vast majority of workers who are exempt from the minimum wage are tipped employees, such as servers in restaurants. And there's about 1.1 million of them, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
And do their tips typically bring them up to where a minimum wage worker would be or more?
They're supposed to by law. The law says that you can pay a tipped employee as little as $2.13 an hour as long as their tips bring them up to the minimum wage. If they don't, then the employer has to make up the difference. Now, state laws may vary. States are free to require higher minimums for tipped workers. Many of them do. They have different rules about how to make up the difference. But that's the federal standard that everyone has to at least adhere to.
So if you raise the minimum wage for most workers, will these tipped employees and others who are exempt be affected by that?
That will be entirely up to the lawmakers, whether to extend any raise to tipped employees. There was some debate about that in Maryland, I believe, a few years ago. But it's up. It really is up to the legislators on how they decide to do it.
There's been so much back and forth from all perspectives on the minimum wage. Is there anything in this whole conversation that surprised you?
I guess what surprised me is when I was looking at this is how the real value of the minimum wage varied so much across the country and any wage, really, because I didn't. Living in D.C., you get used to prices being a certain level. It's easy to think, well, everybody pays what I pay, but they really don't. The price levels and the cost of living around the country vary so much from the national average. It's really hard. You really don't realize that until you actually sit down and look at the numbers.
I saw that in Germany, CEOs make about 150 times what their workers make. In Britain, it's about 84, 85 times. In Japan, about 67 times. But really, is there any standard? I mean, how much is too much?
I think there is no standard. There's no governing statute except for the income tax provision that over, I think it's $1 million. Anything over that has to be incentive-based. But other than that, it's up to whatever the compensation committee of the company decides is appropriate.
So I'm still confused on this. I don't know how much is the correct minimum wage, and I still don't know how much is too much when it comes to CEOs.
Well, welcome to the world of economics.
Drew DeSilver is a senior writer at the Pew Research Center. Drew, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm David Lazarus. When it comes to your finances, we here at Marketplace believe in paying maximum attention to what's going on. But since we're talking about minimums today, let's talk about the minimum you need to do to take charge of your finances. And to help us do that, we're joined by CBS Business News analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thanks for joining us, Jill.
Great to be with you.
So let's kind of approach it first from a newbie to the world of finance. You're just out of college, say. You've left your parents' home, meaning you're now 45 or thereabouts. What do you do to just kind of get the ball rolling?
Well, I think at the very minimum, you need to pay attention to your finances. And that's a little bit easier said than done. It may mean downloading an app and tracking how much money you spend. It may mean pulling out a pen and pad and saying, well, what do I have? What do I owe? I think the most important thing is to engage with your financial life, okay? That's really a big deal. And what I think you do from there is what I call the big three. Number one, you really work hard to pay down outstanding debt. Maybe that's a credit card debt. Maybe that's an auto loan. Maybe it's your student loans. But, you know, you only can figure out how much money to allocate towards debt pay down by looking at how much money you spend. So all of this is going to be connected. Once you pay down your debt, you've got to establish an emergency reserve fund. We're talking about 6 months of your living expenses. Again, if you don't know how much your living expenses are because you haven't been tracking how much money you're spending, then it's hard to accumulate your emergency reserve fund. 6 months in a boring, safe, cash or cash equivalent account like a bank, checking, savings, CD, money market account. And you're ready to graduate to your third step?
Go for it.
Use your retirement plan. If you have an employer-based plan and they have a matching component, you want to start contributing to that, try to get up to the matching level. If you can go beyond that, that's great. If you don't work for a place that has a retirement plan, consider a Roth IRA. Those three steps are kind of your golden three beginning steps for money management, personal financial health.
Okay, but I can hear some of our listeners saying, jeepers, Jill, that makes a lot of sense, but I can't pay down my credit card debt because I'm not pulling in enough money. And 6 months of savings? Are you kidding me?
I think that what we do is we start with baby steps. When you're looking at your own financial life, you're going to whittle things away the best you can. And you've got to start somewhere. I mean, because otherwise, you're in that same place that every dieter has been in, which is, you know, oh, I just don't want to go to the gym and go on a diet. And you've got to start someplace. If you decide that you have $20 a week to allocate to something, we're just talking about priorities. Start with debt pay down. And if you really think that you cannot possibly accumulate 6 months in an emergency reserve, well, if you've got zero, I'll take 1 month. I'll take something. And frankly, if you don't have at least 3 months in an emergency reserve fund, I would really caution you about leaving the nest so quickly. You know, we know that about a quarter of millennials are still living home. And part of that is because, guess why? They want to accumulate more money before they go out and head into the big world.
And speaking of minimums, what is the hazard of paying only the minimum each month on your credit card debt?
Well, that's, you know, it's brutal, actually. You know, it's just you get a very nasty lesson in compounding interest, and it's not the good kind. You know, it's not the way that it's working in your favor. You'll find that all of a sudden the 10 grand that you owe balloons into 15 or 18 or 20 grand pretty quickly. So the minimum is going to keep that credit card company really happy. They're going to love you. They just think you're the best person in the world when you pay the minimum. It's going to keep you mired in debt for a long time.
What's your thought on this, Jill? Are there a minimum number of Americans who are devoting themselves to their finances in the way we've been talking, or is there a maximum number out there?
That's a funny question. I mean, I think that everybody needs to be aware of their financial health. And I will use the analogy of health because, you know, you get checked for certain tests, and when you get to a certain age, you get a colonoscopy, and you do those horrible things because you know what? You know in the long run it's better for you. So the best thing that I can tell you is that this is not rocket science. You know, people get spooked by it. It's emotional. It gets a little freaky. But managing your personal financial life shouldn't be so painful. It should be so much easier in the age of technology. And frankly, it is not something that you should be perseverating over for your, you know, hours on end in a day. You know, go get a hobby, but don't make yourself so crazy about it because most of this stuff has very simple solutions.
And it's worth noting that you're the first person to work the word colonoscopy into the show.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I was thinking about the colonoscopy because I was thinking that a client of mine about 20 years ago said to me, going through the financial planning process is only a little harder than prepping for my colonoscopy. And that's what so if I may use it twice.
Thank you very much. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News, and she knows what she's talking about. Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So we just spoke with Jill about the minimum you need to do when it comes to your finances. But what happens if you've got too much and need a little decluttering in your life? Anyone who's read Marie Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up knows that imposing some order on your surroundings is very important and potentially very satisfying. So could her KonMari decluttering method also be used in money matters? Liz Weston, who is the personal finance columnist for Reuters and Bankrate and author of Your Credit Score, soon to be a major motion picture. I made that last part up. Liz is here to talk about this. Hi, Liz.
Hey, David. How are you?
I'm really well. So you read the book, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. I love that book.
Why?
Because it came from such a different angle than what I'm used to reading about organization. And because she's such a quirky individual. I mean, you know, there's a sort of infusing inanimate objects with animate feelings that's kind of fun. I mean, it's a little quirky, but it's interesting. And also that she's really talking about issues that resonate with those of us who are just obsessed with organization. You know, she's one of us.
How do you apply that to finances?
Yeah, that's a good question. But it struck me as soon as I was reading the book, hey, these are the concepts that we talk about all the time. One of them, for example, is to go big. Now, in organization, the common wisdom is that you do a little bit at a time and you keep doing it. And the author of the book basically said that doesn't work. You're just reorganizing a mess. So what she wants you to do is just go all out. You know, go one category at a time and just get her done, even if it's exhausting. And actually, that can work for your finances, too. You can have, say, 401k accounts all over the place. If you decide, okay, one day I'm going to get all my retirement accounts in shape. Then you do the transfers. Then you look at the investments and get those all coordinated. You get it done, and then you don't have to look at it again for another year or so.
Now, what are some of the other principles here? For example, she recommends that you not start with something that has a lot of sentimental value, like, say, photos or things like that. You would start with books, things that you can, you know, get your hands around quickly. How would you do that in terms of finance?
Well, there are certain issues that are just touchier than others. You know, if you start off with dealing with your debt right away, there's a lot of guilt dealing with that. There's a lot of uncertainty and fear. Estate planning's even worse. I mean, you don't start with your will and talking about dying and thinking about who's going to raise your kids if you're not here. It's just too much. So start with the simpler stuff. Maybe you have, you know, more savings accounts than you need. Maybe you can consolidate those. Or maybe there's something simple you can do, like set up automatic payments for your bills, stuff that isn't so fraught with emotion. And if you get that started, then you're kind of on a roll, and then you can deal with the more difficult things.
Do it all at once or break it apart into different days so you're not feeling so overwhelmed?
I don't know that anybody can get it all done in one day. I think most of us, our financial lives are a little complicated. So I would say one category per day. But do set aside a big chunk of time to deal with these things. You know, it's not enough to try to get it in around the edges. That's why nothing gets done. You know, that's why we keep putting off the tasks that we need to do for our financial life.
One of the more intriguing elements of Marie Kondo's work is this idea that you want to retain the things that give you joy. And if it doesn't give you joy, skidoo, out it goes. When you apply that to finances, it's a little trickier because how do you define that which brings you happiness versus that which is a necessity?
Well, and here we have a perfect example, retirement saving, retirement planning, retirement, blah, you know, that word just doesn't sound very appealing. I'm having to delay gratification, put aside money that I won't see for decades. Ugh. Turn it around. Instead of talking about retirement, think about financial freedom. Think about freedom from work. If that doesn't bring you joy, maybe you're in the right profession. But the idea is that you're seeking a goal that really resonates with you somehow, some way, whatever it is. And once you have that excitement, then you can actually get into planning for it. And it can be anything. I mean, we all need to save for retirement. That's just a given. But if you want to buy a vacation house, if you want to get another car, all those things, you want to have a goal that has a little charge to it or a lot of charge to it. I mean, the whole idea of sparking joy is a pretty big reaction. So that's, I think, what you're looking for.
Are all your T-shirts now folded up into little tiny squares?
My T-shirts, my husband's T-shirts, my daughter's T-shirts. They're all condoed.
Pathetic. I'm sorry. Liz Weston is a personal finance columnist and, as always, a font of wisdom on this program. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always my pleasure.
And that's our show. Lizzie's back next week as we look at the economy of creativity. Don't forget to give us a shout at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski and Charlton Thorpe are our engineers. Our theme music's composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And I'm David Lazarus. Till next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.